Hi, everybody. This is Brett, and welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is June 20th, 2011, and this is the sixth installment in the series of shows we call Keys, where we talk about alternatives and solutions and new ideas, all aimed at addressing this kind of big problem that we have in the country and around the world called government education. And, of course, this is all part of what I feel is the very important task of giving that word, which right now is one of the most misused and misunderstood words in our lexicon, a brand new definition. So this is another one of those collaborations. I got together with the guys from Remedy Radio, and I had been meaning to have Paul Verge, one of the hosts, back on the show for a while. You might remember Paul from the What You've Been Missing show. You can check out more of his work at remedyradio.com, as well as tragedyandhope.com and divergentfilms.com. On this show, we're joined by his co-hosts, Adam and Rob, and we cover a lot of ground, but most importantly for me, the importance of being a self-teacher or an autodidact. And we also talk about some strategies and ideas for engaging other people. And, of course, the importance of pointing out the disparity between the values by which they live their private lives and the violence and aggression they support in their public or political lives. So thank you for listening, and take care. Oh, couple quick notes before we start the show. First of all, this public versus private idea, this was introduced by Stefan Molyneux. If I can find some links where he discusses this, I will put them in the show notes. And one more kind of a technical issue you should know about. In the show, we're on Skype, and we're doing some Skype chat back and forth just to share information. And that sound of the Skype chat shows up in the audio recording. Now, when I went back and first listened to the audio recording, that was driving me nuts because I was like, who is trying to contact me and why can't I see them? And eventually, after like 45 minutes, I realized that it was part of the recording. So I wanted to save you that hassle. But yeah, that's about it. I'm on my way to Porkfest today, so I hope to see you there. Here we go.
When you were growing up in school, was there a point that you were like, I want to be a teacher? Or did it just sort of come along, or were you influenced to become a teacher, or?
You know, it's funny. I was just having a conversation about this very subject with somebody, and I was going through, you know, my typical list of the problems with the government school system, and their response was, well, I had a couple really good teachers. And I asked them to do, who did those very things, who inspired me and made me think. And I said, of course you did. How many teachers did you have? And we calculated that maybe between first and 12th grade, I don't know, 60, 80 to 100 different teachers come and go. You wouldn't be talking about how great dentistry was if you had been to 80 dentists and two of them were competent. So, you know, I did not have maybe more than a handful of teachers that I really enjoyed or respected throughout my entire K through 12 school career. I mean, I really liked my fourth grade teacher. I really liked my English teacher in high school. He did a newspaper elective. But most of them were pretty dry and pretty uninteresting, pretty uninspiring. And it wasn't really until I got to college where I was kind of just going through the motions of higher education. I really didn't have any ambition. I didn't have specific goals for what I wanted to do as a career, and I certainly didn't want to work hard. That's not why I went to college. And I think at the end of my sophomore year, I had a history professor who really inspired me and really, you know, demanded a lot of me. And through that, not only did it spark up my interest in history, but it also made me want to start to look at the possibility of teaching. You know, I liked his whole style. I liked his whole approach. And I was really impressed with the amount of knowledge that he had. He certainly was inserting a lot of his own views in there, as college professors have a tendency to do, and I had to relearn some stuff later. But I think that was you know, I was 20 years old when that first really inspirational teacher, you know, came into my academic life. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because the question made me just think about the whole aspect of what teachers that I even liked, you know, and I can't think of too many, but the ones I can think of were, I remember them because they seemed to be doing the best they could to be as unorthodox as possible within the constraints that they were dealing with. So any teacher that was a little bit, you know, just not like all the other mundane, just doing their job teachers, those are the ones that, you know, I noticed or I can remember as being having any kind of effect on me. Was
so the less they followed the status quo, the more enjoyable it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just trying different things to educate you, to stimulate you, to make you want to be there, right? Because otherwise, you're like, why the hell am I? Like, my 95% of the time, I'm sitting there going, why am I here? Why are you teaching me this? Like, do you even know what you're doing?
Well, and I think the mold itself has gotten a little moldy. So people are just like, this isn't even fulfilling anymore. You know, they go through this whole thing. They're like, okay, I've taken all these classes. Maybe 10-20% of this seems like it'd be relative to anything I'm going to do in life. And you get to the end and you're like, okay, so the solution is, okay, I don't know what I want to do. How about more of this?
Right.
How about another 4 or 5 years? You know what I mean? And if you really, we had this conversation with Erica Goldson talking about degrees and what's the point of getting a degree when a lot of employers don't even care what degree you have. Just the fact that you have one showed that you were willing to pay to sit somewhere for many hours a day that you might not want to be. And so we joked that it was, you know, a degree reflects the level of your degree of conditioning.
Is that why cab drivers all have degrees?
Yeah.
Well, if you look at, you look at some of the most obedient people to authority and some of those who work hardest to maintain the status quo, they are these statist or state-serving intellectuals who we look at their, or I shouldn't say we, but the average person looks at their credentials and they say, oh, well, how could anybody even question Zbigniew Brzezinski? I mean, you know, this guy's got a PhD. This guy spent like 24 years in school, and then he was a professor, so that's like beyond question, I think, to most people.
That's almost godly.
But you're right. It is a sign of a greater amount of conditioning than most of us have to go through, and certainly most of us should go through. We should be going through none. Mm-hmm. 12 years is enough. 16, I did 18 before I dropped out of grad school, like right in the middle of a weekend class where I was like, wow, this is the point. And went and got a job. But, I mean, academia is not the real world.
No.
And I think that even when we're just talking about K-12 education, we have these people who, they go to high school, or they go through K-12, they go to college, they go through their master's program, and then they go back into that system like they know anything, you know, or like they have any experience. So, but that's a really good point, that, you know, the more schooling you have, the more obedient you tend to be. Like, academia is a very obedient profession. Psychology today is a very obedient profession. The medical industry is a very obedient profession. The legal, you know, I mean, these are, we're all talking like 22 years of school for these careers. These are like the most obedient status quo maintaining professions out there.
I wonder if it takes 12 years, if they figured that's what it takes, at least 12 years of conditioning to get us to believe that whatever it is they're trying to educate us to believe is the real world, as opposed to what is real and would be good for us.
Well, if anything, I find it interesting that to get into a position of authority in society, you have to have been authorized to for the longest amount of time, right? As a doctor, a lawyer, maybe not a police officer, but any position where people are going to be looking up to you for answers, you have to have already been indoctrinated by the system an extra long amount of time. And what that really does to me is it narrows your focus of vision to this kind of tunnel vision so that, you know, you're specialized. You know everything. You know tons about this tiny little subject, but you have no contextual information about the rest of that information. So.
Right, right.
So yeah, I think we're going to take our first quick break here on Remedy Radio, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Brett Vinant of the School Sucks podcast. Hi, we're back on Remedy Radio with our special guest, Brett Vinat, and we're communicating solutions today about the education system, about what's really going on, and how it works to condition and dumb us down. There's a new film that came out recently called The College Conspiracy, where it talks about the conspiracy to essentially price out education, to inflate, that the cost of education has inflated much more than the cost of a lot of other basic services. And that's interesting on one level because it prevents people from being able to get the quote-unquote education they need. But I thought on another level, it serves to create the appearance of value to the college education system, whereas it doesn't actually have as much value as you think. Mm-hmm. It's almost like inflating the cost of education is like a red herring to make people think it's worth even more, as opposed to becoming an autodidactic learner.
Well, what was it? It's inflated like 9 times, and it's been diluted every time it's been inflated, so to speak, right?
Yeah, so the cost of education's gone up while the quality's gone down. So maybe you can talk about that aspect, Brett.
Now, we're talking specifically about higher education,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, and of course, it doesn't mean that the same thing isn't true over the course of the last 4 or so decades in public education in general, with the cost per year per student versus the quality, even by their own measurements of how good the system is. But the higher education system is very interesting, and I think that that's certainly an interesting and valid assertion that they are trying to, you know, price some people out of that. There's no incentives for the kind of people who have the power to influence that, the structure of that system, to have an educated society. I think the only thing, on an economic standpoint, that's keeping pace with the escalating costs in higher education is healthcare. Mm-hmm. And these are two industries that are very, very, very heavily subsidized and have been, you know, I mean, it started with the higher education system with Pell Grants, I believe. And we just see this huge tidal wave of money. If people want to go $80,000, $100,000, $120,000 into debt without any guarantee anymore of a career from that piece of paper, that's certainly available to them. But unfortunately, that's sending a signal to private and public institutions that, you know, if all of this money is available for these services, that the tuition prices have been jacked up. I mean, I see there's an economic explanation for that. Similar in, you know, healthcare, it's like, here, have this service now, pay for it later, or somebody else will pay for it entirely. I hate to say it, but with the economics education that you have by the time that you're 18 years old, generally speaking, in the public schools, and you're told that you can go to school for free, or you can go to, even if you just care about, like, going and making friends and partying and drinking and maybe, you know, checking out some classes and getting some direction in life, and you can pay later. Well, when is later? How does that work? Is there interest? I mean, those aren't even questions, I think, for a lot of kids. It's just like, oh, later? Sweet.
Deferring
the cost in education and in healthcare has led to people to be even more reckless consumers than many people are already in those two areas, which has just sent costs skyrocketing in both places.
Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people aren't aware as well that, at least as of this podcast date, that a lot of universities are now offering their courses and curriculums online for little or no money. So even like top universities, Yale, all these other ones, so-called top, they people don't even have to pay just to go to the physical location. You can find online a lot of the same books, a lot of the same curriculums, a lot of the same courses, I guess, and not pay $100,000.
I guess you just don't get the degree, right? Is that the deal?
Yeah, you don't get the degree unless you're enrolling and going through that whole process, right? But what's more important, I guess it's important for some people to get the piece of paper at the end.
Yeah.
But the piece of paper doesn't bring any guarantee whatsoever. So I think the more valuable thing is the experience. Like, what are you learning? And then having people to bounce those ideas off of, right? To have those discussions with about what you're learning.
I think we also see how rusty and crusty and antiquated the public's idea of what education is has become. The reason I think why higher education needed to cost money, or why there was value in that service, is because in the 19th century and through most of the 20th century, that kind of knowledge, that compendium of knowledge in all these different subject areas where people who were legitimate experts in a field could come in and help other people attain that knowledge, that was hard to come by. I mean, but today, that's easy. You're right. iTunes University. I spent plenty of time on there with the, you know, variety of education and economics courses and history courses from some of what is considered to be the best universities in the country. I think now there really isn't as much value in that stuff because it's so ubiquitous and all you're paying for is a piece of paper these days.
Exactly. Well, it's funny that you should mention that because my friend went for a job interview and which was considered to be, you know, one of these corporate jobs, and it was, you know, a sought after position, and during the interview they were asking him, you know, what do you do when you run into a situation where you don't know the answer? And his answer was, I Google it. You know, so the wealth of information that's on the internet is just, you know, is enough to be an autodidact, right? It's enough to be able to, you know, learn from other people's mistakes, so to speak, right?
Well, there's no end to the accessibility in terms of tons of information, more than a human being could ever learn in their entire lifetime.
Yeah.
I think, and so now it's coming to a matter of sifting through the information and finding where's the true knowledge, right? And traditionally, higher education had been to kind of deliver the final seeds of whatever thing you were going to go off to do, to give you the, you know, whether it was apprenticing or doing trade or, you know, learning the final, you know, philosophies and proper methodologies of critical thinking. Yeah. It gave you this opportunity, but now it's been essentially corporatized, right? Into you know, with the combination of the Prussian style education, the obedience factoring, the conditioning, then most people going to these universities now, they're just propping up the institution and the illusion of its, you know, how revered it is.
And so how important it still is, which is becoming pretty illusory.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's almost like the record companies propping up their own self-importance, right? Now the university model is becoming less relevant because you can learn from your own home and self-empower yourself. Like, between real knowledge, which you can actually learn at your own pace, pick and choose which areas you're studying, instead of this cookie-cutter, one-size-fits-all, you know, the professor's lecturing, inserting his opinions, you can go and check out 50 different viewpoints on the same thing, which was never an option in university. You at least had, like, a range of a few textbooks, right? So I would ask you, Brett, how do you see this education paradigm changing or shifting with this open-source internet learning and podcast learning?
Well, I think that, I mean, this is something now that's been going on for two decades. Obviously, the last 10 years has been far superior. But it seems to be a slow process because so many of the people who are, you know, forming the public opinion and so many of the people who are policymakers and decision makers are still stuck in this old way of thinking. They still want to talk about, you know, telegraphs and typewriters. I mean, just to give a technological equivalent. And people always want this question answered about designing a centralized, one-size-fits-all system. If you don't like what we have, what will be next? And the truth is, it just doesn't need to be that way anymore. And one of the important priorities with my show is to redefine the word education. Education is not these people being packed into these buildings and told what's important and what to do and when they did it well. That everything has changed. The entire game has changed with this information revolution. And I think a lot of people don't want to embrace that. I think a lot of older people, like I said, the people who are voting and the people who are politicians or making policy or the sort of behind-the-scenes bureaucrats, they are not adaptable. I think that once somebody, I heard that the greatest age of trainability is like 13, 14, 15 years old, and it's all downhill after 30. But when people get to be like 40 and 50, I mean, most people, they really, really struggle with new ideas and changes in society, and they start doing this sort of, I call it the magical fruit moment, like from the Bible, where everything was good and everything was pure, and then this woman ate this fruit, and then all hell broke loose. And they keep wanting to go back to, like, in their life, before this sin, before everything was corrupted. Someone in my family always talks about how great the 50s were.
Yeah.
You're a white guy. They were fine.
Yeah.
But I think when you mentioned before being an autodidact and how easy that is, it's hard not to be that today. Mm-hmm. I really think. And you see older people as these facts are like swarming around them, like, trying to fight them off and run away because they don't want that information because it's challenging the paradigms and the belief systems that give them such great comfort and have for so long. But you have to be making an effort not to be learning and having your ideas challenged constantly in today's information.
It's true. Well, we'll talk more about adapting to today's learning environments when we come back in this episode of Remedy Radio. Back on this special episode of Remedy Radio with our special guest Brett Vinott of the School Sucks podcast. We're talking about all sorts of things on education, conditioning, the effect on dumbing down the populace, and what we can do to effectively self-educate and get a little bit of our power of learning back. So,
I wanted to sort of share something. Your adaptability to change is what will ensure your survival in the future. And I think that rings really true with what you said before we break in terms of these people who have been conditioned, severely conditioned, and then, are trying to prevent you from eating this apple, that all hell doesn't break loose, So I think that the whole change thing, in embracing the change, instead of fearing it, will definitely make things easier for you at the end, right?
Well, yeah.
One of the things that's running lateral to that, as far as the goals of my show are concerned, today people who fear change and benefit from the way things are, who reap all of these rewards from the status quo and the maintenance of the status quo, they have a very, very powerful and dangerous tool. I shouldn't even call it a tool, a weapon, that they can use to prevent change, to stop competition, to stop new ideas from emerging, and that's the state. And, these voluntarist ideas that we're talking about on School Sucks podcast, the idea of non-aggression is a very, very important one, because while we do have to realize the hole we're in, the hole that we've been dug and dumped into through our 15,000 hours of government school, it's also important to realize the other institutions that are preventing much-needed evolutionary change from taking place in society, because, the people who have the power and the people who have the control also have this incredibly powerful weapon that in this 12-year process we also learned was benevolent and helpful. It was kind of like a Salvation Army for the whole world, but that's not what it is, and that's not what it does. And I think that in addition to the lesson of school or the lessons of school that lead to the demolition of the individual, that lead to the demolition of individuality and curiosity, we also have this construction project going on alongside it of this mythology of this great benevolent overseer that just wants to help and just wants the best and just wants to keep us safe. And that's not reality. So I think that it's important to realize, before we can even talk about solutions, and I would have liked to spend more of the almost 100 episodes of School Sucks podcast that I've done talking about alternatives and talking about different strategies. They just keep making more news for me, too, with these zero-tolerance crackdowns and
The
TSA at the prom and the treatment of kids in with pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to get ahead, but it's like they're moving faster than I am. They're a little more powerful than me, the government education system. But yeah.
I'm hoping
to get to more.
Yeah. Absolutely, and I think one of the biggest solutions, or at least half the solution, is correctly identifying the problem. You can hack away at branches and leaves and everything until you're blue in the face, but unless you correctly identify what the root is, you're in a sense, you're wasting your time and energy. And since the root is the pernicious dumbing down of education and the forcing of us to fund our own slavery system, essentially, right? Like you've talked about the parallels between the state and enforcing public education like the mafia. And so I think one of the biggest solutions is correctly identifying that the biggest problem is the state. The state is not this benevolent entity, even though it's supposed to be our representative. It's been hijacked a long time ago by a variety of interests, that none of which reflect us, the public. And it's very carefully managed PR. So it's doing its best, while being run by criminals, to appear as criminal-free and corrupt-free as possible. And the fact that we've been so dumbed down kind of dissuades us, or keeps us at a disadvantage to correctly identifying that this is, in fact, the problem. And so I think the 100 episodes of School Sucks are essential to correctly identify not just the core problem, but all the feeder aspects that keep the roots perpetuating and growing. And that once you've identified that, then the solutions that are available or plentiful will make themselves apparent, whether it's pulling your kids out and home educating them and creating a situation where that's possible, or, you know, spending more time learning on the internet or getting a hold of the Trivium, or, you know, there's so many different avenues that people can do to take their power back. So how much value do you yourself place in becoming an autodidact and an autonomous learner versus being dependent on the state?
Well, I mean, obviously, that's the difference between freedom and slavery. There was this great quote. I can't pronounce the woman's name who said it, but I can send you the link and you can put it with your show notes. It's definitely on my website. There's no neutral education. Education is either for freedom or domestication. So it's not like, I remember I was down at UConn and one of the students asked me, well, don't you think that they're doing, like, the best that they can, and, you know, even though the system's not great, the intentions of it are good, and they just can't do it any better. They just can't make it any better because of what it is. And, you know, my response was, I think, like, if you can't afford to buy somebody an ice cream, you don't punch them in the face. You know what I mean? It's it's opposite. It's different ends of the spectrum. The government education system is not about education. It's not about freedom. It's not about, even if we want to start using platitudes like being a good citizen or participating in society or democracy, it's about none of that. It's about basically being declawed and, you know, made to accept the edicts and the suggestions of authority without question. So if that's the only education people have, and I would not only include you know, government school and higher education, like a four-year degree, you are intellectually defenseless. You are intellectually helpless. And that, some people can overcome that on their own, I think, but I don't even really feel like there needs to be any kind of prescription for how to do that, because it's so easy. And people are going to, you know, stumble into this online world, and they're also seeing, I think, young people. I mean, this is my experience from the young people that I've worked with and that I've spoken with in a lot of the classes that I've done when we've had some time to do group discussion. They can see that their teachers, that the authority figures, the adults in their lives really don't have much of a clue, like, what's going on with them, or they really, like, they forgot how to be in touch. Like, I remember I would have problems with my dad when I was like 16 and he was like 45. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would say, you know, when I'm an adult, I'm going to be cool, and kids, I'm going to understand kids. And I started working with kids when I was 21, And after like 6 months, I was like, wow, I'm already not cool. And I think when it wasn't because I didn't understand kids and I didn't sympathize with them. It was just I was in this position of arbitrary authority over them. And I couldn't show that sympathy and I couldn't make those connections because my job was to get them to be manageable and to follow rules.
So that probably reflected a lot of realities back to you about that role, that it's you are teaching, you're trying to impart knowledge and understanding and wisdom, but in a sense, at least by today's standards, it's become more like a daycare for management so that both parents can work to support the new unfair economy that pays you half as much for twice as much work.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that.
But then again, there's a huge sense of freedom that comes with learning that, and it becomes sort of a catalyst to start questioning a little bit more, you know?
Yeah. Mm.
Mm-hmm. That's when you sort of, the light bulb sort of clicks and says, hey, wait a minute, nobody around me has a clue. Maybe I should start
getting one.
Yeah, exactly, you know?
Well, that can become kind of addictive, too, because I think at first, it's a very, very bitter, salty, jagged pill to swallow, the idea that you've been lied to your entire life by all these authority figures, by the system that was supposed to educate you, by even the people that you consider to be benevolent, in many cases, figures of authority, like your parents in certain aspects. And I think that the sooner you can help somebody in their life understand this, which is why I focus on teenagers and young adults, the better the chances that they will be able to break free of it. But if you go up to somebody who's, a baby boomer, and you start having conversations like this, they
actually get tired.
They get what?
Physically
they get tired. Yeah, they start yawning. And it's just, you know what? Like, my mom had a few things. And my mom's starting to, you know, really, really wake up, eh? And she starts yawning, literally. Adam, it's quite a bit right now.
You're straining my brain. You're making it. The electrons.
That's funny that it would have like a volume effect, because in my experience, maybe it has something to do with my my style or my approach, but for me it has more of like a crystal meth PCP effect, where these people are just going crazy, and they start attacking me personally, they start doing the ad hominem, and they really several people, both family and people outside of family, when they're in that age group, and it's not that it's never happened with somebody my own age, but it's far more rare, they have a really negative emotional reaction to a lot of these ideas. And I think a lot of the time they already know that these ideas are sound, because all of these ideas, educational, social, political, are based on an underlying principle that can be consistently applied, that can be universalized, which is the non-aggression principle. Mm-hmm. Now, empirically, if they look at the value of that, all of the people that I associate with already live their personal lives by that axiom. But when we go to their public lives, they're fantasizing about aggression against all kinds of people. And I think that that's, it's really hard to reconcile. And I think they understand how obvious that is, but they just don't want to accept it. It was hard for me to accept initially as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the ideas of non-force, non-aggression, non-coercion, and
sure.
How they are these important sort of first principles to base all our other interactions on, because those were concepts even I didn't really get until the last few years about just how important they are as a bedrock of interaction.
I think that the danger, I mean, if we want to deal with the utility of it, there's a real danger in saying there's different ethical standards for different groups of people, right? That's what makes every horror in the world pretty much possible. Where I wear this costume so I can behave this way, or I sit in this chair so I can do these things, but you can't do them. I mean, that just opens the floodgates for all kinds of theft and aggression and predation. And I think that the state itself, which is an outgrowth of that, I mean, the state, in my understanding of it, was not something that came about to stop these roving, hordes of people who would storm into a village and kill people and take their stuff, the state is like the modern version of that. You know what I mean? The state is a more sophisticated... And over the last 1,000 years, the state has become more and more and more sophisticated. Like, I do this because I'm bigger. I mean, that's how it started thousands of years ago, but that doesn't have any longevity. People aren't going to go for that, especially when only a very small group of people will behave this way in this violent, insane, sociopathic aggression against other people. So they're always outnumbered, and then, all right, well, we got to make up some kind of a story. I'm God. No, all right, God told me to do it. No, okay, my friends talk to God. I do God's will. No, all right, well, I do the people's will. And we see how this goes up from ancient Egypt to the rise of democracies in the 17th mm-hmm. and 18th century. Mm-hmm. So even the worst people in the world understands that there needs to be a rationalization for this. We look at United States foreign policy and the aggression that the U.S. military and the U.S. government has shown around the world in the last 100 years. Never, ever, ever would they be the aggressor. Would they be the one who initiated force? There's a ship that blows up. There's a base that gets bombed. There's ships that blow up. That's kind of a common one, right? They did that. That was the Vietnam too. Yeah. So even through propaganda and the molding of public opinion, the government and the military understands that they can never look like the aggressor. If they clearly are the aggressor, that just needs to be erased from the history books and kept out of the media. Mossadegh, Iran, 1953, not in the textbooks. No. Allende, Chile, not in the textbooks. Wilson, all of the stuff that Woodrow Wilson did in South and Central America, Mexico, Cuba, not Haiti, not in the textbook. Because there's really no way to reinvent that as good, or to recast America as
the innocent party, or the responding
to some act of aggression.
And I think it's interesting because people are now forced to come up in order to agree with the status quo, which has shifted towards a pro-aggression, pro-coercive, pro-force sort of stance. People have had to come up with these somewhat insane and definitely fallacious rationalizations towards accepting this new paradigm of, shoot first and ask questions later, preemptive, preventative warfare, which is a total oxymoron, you know?
Well, who's on the dollar? Yeah. Who's on our bills, right? Or who's on the monetary system's bills? The one who actually originally weren't for it, right?
Oh, yeah, in the States, yeah, they put everyone who's against the banks on the money. But here we have queens and stuff.
But Paul, just to provide at least one concise answer during the show to one of your questions, I think that, as far as the non-aggression principle goes, this idea, what the effort needs to be in our conversations or in our media we have to show people that this is a principle, that this is an axiom that they're already living by in their private lives. And we should only be talking to people, obviously, who adhere to that. You know, if you're having a conversation about the immorality of the initiation of force and the person's like, oh, no, it's okay, I'm a burglar and a hitman, then move on, to somebody else. But personalizing these arguments and saying, you wouldn't do this, you wouldn't do this to me, you wouldn't support aggression against me to see these public policies that you want enacted. Mm-hmm. And I think that most people will, if they're reasonable, that will give them enough pause that you can, it'll give you a window at least to start putting some of these ideas forward. But most people, almost all people, and this is why it's necessary to always cast the government or the military as the defender and not the aggressor, is because the propagandists know that most people are like this. Most people don't accept aggression. Most people won't cheer for aggression. They only cheer for aggression if it's aggression as retribution.
Yeah, counterattacking.
Or reprisal.
Yeah.
So what we need to do is to help people alert people to the fact that all we're doing, all I'm doing anyway, is putting forward a principle that they already have empirically found works in their private life, and now let's just apply it to public life, to our societal mm-hmm. life.
Yeah, and you're giving it a name so that they can actually work with it. You know, a lot of people, they don't go study philosophy, or they don't even understand the concept of first principles at all. So to start them in a place where they can not only go, oh, okay, I do identify with that because I'm already using those principles in my life. I just didn't know to call them that. It's like, you know, deductive critical thinking, where they're already, a lot of people are already using that. They just don't know to call it the trivium or grammar, logic, rhetoric, and all this stuff.
And one way I would say it too, and I've explained it to young people, with this pyramid of persuasion where we get to a foundation where there can be no argument. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I've asked people in these political conversations that I've had, all right, so I've articulated a principle underlying my entire belief system. You call yourself a conservative. Can you articulate a principle underlying your entire belief system? And they would say, America's the greatest country in the world. Okay, well, that's not an axiom. That's like a subjective preference. And these are smart people who are so... I was going to say unschooled, but that's more of a positive. They're so
schooled
in kill logic that they can't, they can't even make sense of these relatively simple concepts, or they don't want to. And I think it, it varies from person to person, and it has nothing to do with intellect. This is not an intellectual battle we're fighting. I don't think. I think even though a lot of people have had the natural tools stolen from them. It's more, they still retain some intellect, and this is more emotional than anything.
Yeah, and I think, if anything, those principles can act as a filter in conversation where you can discern what a person's level is in terms of their kind of awareness, because if they claim to be against the war, but they're for Guantanamo Bay, or they're, you know what I mean? If they're picking and choosing where aggression and force and coercion are acceptable, then you know where they don't stand against those things as axioms themselves, that they're, you know, well, some equality for some other more than others, you know what I mean? Or as long as I don't know the person, then it's okay. As long as it's a faceless person, then I don't care what the state does to them. Because I feel protected when the state is victimizing others on my behalf.
Yeah, well, violence also, I mean, that's another problem with the state, is that violence becomes more acceptable the more distance you put between the person who's supporting that violence and whoever is the recipient of that violence. Mm-hmm. Like, if I lined up 100 Iraqis to the most, pro-war conservative, and I said, 5 of those people are terrorists, shoot them all, and you'll be sure that you got them. You know, I don't think many people would, if they were put face-to-face with the violence, that they would be able to follow through. But as we put all of these buffers between them cheering for it and the end recipient, dying in a pool of their own blood, it becomes more acceptable. It becomes easier to swallow.
Yeah, they're detached from the consequences.
Right.
And we can delude ourselves easier.
Yeah. It's like a video game when you fly the drone and you go kill people. Just like a video game.
I don't have to hear their screams, so it's not really happening.
Yeah.
What's that phrase about humans being the only animal or something?
The only animal capable of deluding themselves.
Yeah. So, that's a powerful thing. Well, let's take a quick little break, and we'll come back with Brett Venata of the School Sucks podcast when we return on Remedy Radio, communicating solutions. And we're back on Remedy Radio, where we tell people to eat more kale because it's good for you, to enrich your mind and body. Speaking of enriching your mind, we're speaking with Brett Venata of the School Sucks podcast, and that's all about helping you unlearn the damaging things that you've been inculcated with in 12 years or 16,000 hours of education. So, Brett, you've definitely done a lot of study and lived a lot of the experience of what you're talking about. How do you see this public education system fitting into a larger scheme of, social engineering and cultural manipulation?
Well, I think that what we see as far as the control and the management of public opinion through this molding and manipulating of young minds is nothing new in civilization. I'm sure it's gone on for thousands of years. The public school system in its, you know, modern incarnation, which started in Europe in the early half of the 19th century and traveled to the United States in the latter half of the 19th century, is just a modern version of something that's been going on for a long time. I would think that the school system in a place like Sparta might not have looked too different as far as just conditioning people to be these cogs in a machine for the good of the rulers of society. Mm-hmm. I think that it really, as far as solutions are concerned, it really needs to be a ground-up process. I think that one of the most important things to look at, and I didn't even realize how important it was when I started doing the show, was the family. And parenting and how children are treated. Because I think if people continue to use these traditional models of parenting, these authoritarian, you know, because I said so, because I'm your mother, arguments from authority, when that child is 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, school, which is also just an argument from authority, is going to start making a lot of sense. And after another 6 or 7 years of that, when they go out into the real world, they're going to look at the adult society and they're going to say, oh, I'm totally used to this, you know, all of the arbitrary laws and fines that are imposed on them and the constant threats and demands and inconveniences from their local or state or federal government. But I think if children were raised with respect and genuine love, they would, and they never went to these compulsory government schools. If they turned 18 and they went out into adult society, they would look around them and say, what the hell is going on here? What's wrong with these people? Mm-hmm. I think that school has been instrumental in a lot of the changes that we've seen in the United States in the last century plus. I think that, you know, the rise of the central banking system, the tax system, imperialism are all consequences of the state having control over these young minds for such a lengthy and influential period in their lives. These things, would they have been possible before? And certainly were horrors perpetrated against people before? Sure. But people were smart enough in the United States in the 1870s and the 1880s to resist, a lot of people, to resist the advent of this government education system, and they understood that it was incredibly dangerous to turn the molding of the minds of children over to the state, because that would be the end of freedom, you know? Yeah. There is no, like the quote said, there is no neutral education. You're either educating, being educated to be led out, to be liberated, or you're being educated for slavery.
And it's not in the state's rational self-interest to educate people on how to be resistant to the state, on how to be critical of, and how to look at the state as a potential corruptive source. It wouldn't be any advantage for the state to train people to look at reality that way, right?
Well, when you say something like that, and when I've said something like that in the past, people say, conspiracy! You know, that sounds very suspicious to them, that, oh, would the state have such malevolent intentions? I encourage people, we've got an election season, go watch these debates, and, you know, keep a little notebook with you, and just make a tally mark that any time you think that one of these candidates is talking to you at more than a 10th grade reading level, mm-hmm. you know? And you can see how much respect these people have for your intellect. They understand that. The managers of public opinion and these little puppets that they put out for these puppet shows every once in a while, they have no respect for the intellect of the average person. I did a 35-minute segment on a recent show of mine dissecting Obama's speech about bin Laden's death. It was incredibly insulting. It was incredibly insulting where he gets up there and he makes this, you know, pretty astonishing claim that the U.S. military has killed bin Laden, And if you have any respect at that point for the intellect or the curiosity of the public, you would say, all right, well, here's what happened. Here's the evidence. Here's the proof. Why would you trust me? I'm just a stranger. After all, I used to be a lawyer. So here's the case I'm making to back up this mm-hmm. assertion, because it's important to me that you trust me and you believe me. No, he launches into some, fluffy, helium-filled platitudes about the sky being blue and planes cutting through it. And of course, I mean, it's horrible to think about that stuff, but instead of offering us evidence to back up a claim that he's making, he and his speechwriters decide to attack the emotions of the viewers to, remove the possibility of critical thinking. Because if you want somebody to not be able to think about something critically or rationally, the best thing to do is to get them to think about it emotionally. And then everything else is blocked out.
And
there's never anyone in the interrogation room at the police station being asked about why they beat up some guy in a bar, and they say, oh, well, you know, it was I calculated and I figured it was a good opportunity for me to teach him a lesson, and, you know, the fastest tool that I could access was my fist. No, they say, I lost control. I lost my mind. I was drunk. I don't know what I was doing. Yeah. You know, I mean, emotion is certainly an avenue to bad decisions, and politicians seem to be very, very good, and we've seen them really master it in the last decade. I'm sure they were great at it before, mm-hmm. of getting people to think about these things in emotional ways so they cannot think about them logically.
And in that way, they're able to use fallacious arguments, fallacious logic and reasoning, and once they've got you in that emotional state, the fallaciousness can be rationalized, can be made to make sense, right? And it's funny that you brought up that particular video, because Jan Ervin just put out a version of that video for pop-up fallacies, and Obama's got over 80 fallacies in the 9-minute time span, and it actually, as he makes the fallacies and commits them, they pop up, whether it's equivocation or misleading vividness or appealing to the neglected aspect or whatever it is. You can see this video online, and it's somewhat humorous, because you realize just how much, like, people can actually see specifically what you're talking about, Brett, about how much fallacious reasoning he uses, describing the blue sky with the planes flying through it and all. It's designed completely to evoke an emotional reaction, which will be against logic, which will not serve your own interests. And so I think it gives us the opportunity to talk about, I think we've correctly identified the problem is public education. So maybe for the rest of this segment and in our last segment, we can talk about some of these kind of solutions in terms of what people can look into that will help empower their ability to become an autodidact. So, you know, the trivium, identifying the fallacies, listening.
Diet.
Yeah, well, diet's a huge one.
Diet's huge, right?
Yeah.
Sure.
So, you and... who's it, Stefan Molyneux of Free Domain Radio, have talked about the first principles, the non-aggression, non-force, non-coercion, about recognizing the state for what it is. What other aspects do you think people can look into to find themselves their own sense of empowerment?
Well, I think that independence is something that starts at certainly a personal level. And we, in this education system, are taught in so many ways dependence and the value of sort of disappearing, our individual self disappearing into a group of likeness and sameness. And I think that all of these changes that we want to see in society or in education, in any aspect that people are particularly concerned about, they have to start on an individual level. And I think that people need to start trying to develop, first of all, as much independence as possible. And that's with respect to their finances. That's a tough one right now. But, you know, understanding microeconomics and health, of course, is a very important one. It's very empowering to take care of yourself, to eat well, That's also, I would say, extremely important. And you build up from the bottom. I think that people have this habit of they understand these ideas.
Wow. And
sorry. That was, yeah. That's, yeah. Our time.
Okay. And they say, well, you know, oh, I can't believe all this stuff is going on. What are we going to do about the military-industrial complex?
Yeah.
Well, that's really kind of like shooting yourself in the foot as far as personal growth is concerned, because there's all of these concentric circles that are closer to you, that are you know, in this sphere of control with you at the center. Why start at the most distant place possible, where you're probably just going to get frustrated and you're just going to burn yourself out? Like, I'm not really, if you listen to the entirety of the show, it's not really like I'm targeting the NEA or the Department of Education, because those things are way out of my sphere of influence and control. I really believe, and certainly I'm no master of this personally, and this is a constant journey and a constant struggle in many ways, but you have to start with yourself and finding ways to you know, empower yourself on a personal level. I mean, making friends with people and getting connected, which is easier today than ever, with like-minded people will certainly help, I think, especially younger folks, where if I was saying these things in 1985, or any of us were saying these things to our social circles or our families in 1985, we would have been so isolated. And if we were teenagers expressing a lot of these ideas, they just would have been beaten out of us. You know, maybe not literally, but certainly with ridicule and indignation. And it haunts me to think how many great minds with revolutionary and incredibly beneficial ideas have walked this earth in the past two millennia, who asserted themselves and spoke up about some idea that ran against the grain or against the status quo and had it beaten out of them by the dogmas of their society. I'm sure that's happened a lot. But today, that's not something that we really have to face anymore. I mean, still we have to deal with hostile people once in a while, but we can get connected to people and to communities that will, you know, help us strengthen our arguments and feel better about ourselves as well.
I think
that, again, it's never been so easy to get that kind of independence and self-empowerment and self-reliance as it is today. People are lining up on the internet to help you do these things for free.
Yeah.
Free.
Yeah, it's true. And I guess the other side of that coin is that we're dealing with a lot of apathy. A lot of people who've gone through this education system have had their creativity and their curiosity kind of snuffed out. So, you know, why do you think it's important for people to get curious, start embracing learning, empowering themselves, and exploring their world? Like, how do we cure this apathy, I guess, would be the real question.
Well, I think there needs to be a spark. And I think that, you know, people like us, certainly all of us don't agree on everything, but I think we're all on the right track, you know what I mean? And it's a constant learning process. But people like us need to be out there engaging people who are not like us. And I deal with a lot of people here in New Hampshire and a lot of people that I've known that are, you know, pushing people out of their lives for disagreements or for the frustration they experience. And I seem to keep going back for more and finding new people. I mean, I watched on Facebook all of these union people in Wisconsin run away from me in all different directions for wanting to ask them questions. I mean, I wasn't asserting myself as any kind of expert on that situation. I just had questions. So most people want to run away from questions, but I think people like us are seeking out people who have different mindsets or different viewpoints, and we want to engage them, and we need to engage them, because you never know what it's going to be, what you're going to say that's going to spark up somebody else's curiosity, and you never know what idea one of us could put forward that somebody else is going to look at and somebody else is going to be inspired by and how they're going to run with it. So all I can do is try to put out this message, and it's not a message that I entirely came up with myself. Obviously, I've had a lot of inspirational figures and educational figures in my development, but to put it out there to as many people as possible And it's, you know, it's not always perfect, it's not always right, but hopefully it gets people thinking, and I hope other people will do the same thing. Not go and, you know, just wholesale dump all your beliefs on somebody in an aggressive way. I've tried that, it doesn't work. But start asking questions. You know, start asking questions about the issues of the day come up. And fortunately, when it comes, it's not fortunate, it's actually really unfortunate, but when it comes to the state, the government is kind of creeping and crawling into more and more aspects of our lives. You could have a conversation about your health 40 years ago without it being a political discussion. You could have a conversation about getting on a plane and going on vacation 10 years ago, and it wouldn't have been a political discussion. But because of the encroachment of the state into our lives, now both of those things are very political discussions. You know, with the TSA and the healthcare debate, we can't have those conversations anymore without involving the government, because the government involves itself in more and more aspects of our personal lives. So more things can become these potentially productive conversations. And I also say to people, push through the whole, you know, everyone's entitled to their opinion thing. You know,
they are through
that and say you're entitled to say whatever you want, but you're not entitled to be taken seriously unless you can back it up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And don't let slightly uncomfortable conversations end before they could evolve into productive conversations, because people will try to cut you off. I mean, that's a pretty placid way of doing it, to say, well, you know, I have my opinion and you have your opinion. Ask, tell me about your opinion.
Yeah.
You know, what's it based on? Where did it come from? And being inquisitive has been the best approach for me. It doesn't mean that I won't take the bait of a very hostile person and wind up raising my voice once in a while still. But the inquisitive approach, the Socratic, the gadfly approach, has worked best to get people thinking without being overly confrontational. So I think that's really
important. I believe that's also a form of negotiations as well, right?
Mm.
I mean, we're so used to not negotiating for anything these days, right? We're back in the day.
No, everything is win-lose.
Yeah.
Everything's a win-lose situation. You can't have win-win.
Yeah. And back in the day, it was a common thing to negotiate. Well, I'll give you this many of these things that I got for that many of those things that you got, right? And now it's like, well, that's the price. Take it or leave it. You know, win or lose.
Yeah,
right?
Well, the philosophy of value, I think, has been warped, right? When Brett was mentioning that all this information and knowledge, sorted knowledge, is available for, oh, that's weird, for free, that essentially people don't see it as being as valuable because of the fact that it's available for free. It's almost like it has to cost money for it to be worth something, and they can't just see that there might be an inherent value in the knowledge or the acquisition of knowledge. So, you know, I find it very interesting. I don't know if you had any questions there, Rob, that you wanted to...
Yeah, well, I was going to ask, you mentioned your influences and people who have inspired you, so I was wondering if you'd like to mention any of those people and your influences and inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sure. Well, I was fortunate enough to grow up in a family that was, as much as it was far from perfect, both my parents were educated, and even though they're in their 60s today, they still remain relatively open-minded and easy to talk to and easy to engage about these ideas. And it doesn't mean we've never argued about these things, but, you know, I do appreciate, their initial influence of, you know, the value of real education. And my mother was a teacher until I was born, and she had no fantasies about what the school system could really offer, and spent a lot of time with me, you know, when I was four, when I was five, learning to read. And my father was the same, and he wanted me to, from a very young age, understand, you know, the issues of the day. And, you know, I appreciate that influence, but high school kind of killed that for me, and it wasn't until this college professor that I mentioned who was a real big inspiration. I've been meaning to get him on my show eventually, but I don't want to have it turn into an hour of us arguing about economics or how great Franklin Roosevelt was.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of still planning that out a little bit. But when I started to discover all of this alternative media, iTunes, I initially became very interested in this gentleman who hosts a show called Complete Liberty. He's an author. He has a psychological background. His name is Wes Bertrand. He was probably at the time, this was 2006, 2007, one of the best people I had ever heard as far as articulating these ideas were concerned. From there, I was turned on to Stefan Molyneux and Free Domain Radio, and I've absorbed a tremendous amount of that. You know, no one could possibly... Steph has said so many things that nobody could possibly agree with everything that he's ever said, but he will... if the goal of his show is to get people to think and ask questions, and sometimes think in ways that are uncomfortable personally, he will never waste a half hour of your time. He's a, you know, he's absolutely brilliant. He's a, he's very engaging.
He's funny.
He's funny. And I think that I've really gained a lot, not just with respect to my education on these issues and, you know, these philosophical principles, but my personal life as well has really benefited from my my exposure to Free Domain Radio. And the truth is that I'm surrounded by a lot of great people, and I've had the fortune of meeting and interacting with people that I used to just listen to and admire from afar, like Richard Grove. I started listening to, it was one of the first podcasts I ever listened to when I got my first little iPod, you know, 5 years ago. And, you know, today we're friends, today we've worked together, and I think that's great. And I think that's been one of the real benefits of being a media creator, is that you put this stuff out there. And the story has been, for me anyway, a lot of these people that I just used to kind of admire from afar have actually reached out to me, and we work together now. Mm-hmm. And that's beautiful. Rich, Steph, Wes, I've worked with all those guys, and that's really great. It's the kind of stuff that would not have been possible a generation ago.
I had a question to ask. So, you know, you're really engaged in promoting the work that you do. So outside of work, is there something that you do to unwind, or is there something that you do to sort of reset the whole thing, or
to relax?
To relax, yeah. Like,
how does
that's, you know what? That's not so much a question as a suggestion that I should really consider seriously. Because no, I don't. I really don't.
You still listen to music? You go to see music?
Sure. In the car. Sometimes in the car, I will listen to podcasts. And sometimes on a long trip, I'll be like, no, it's time to rock. I play the guitar a little bit.
Do you get to go out to shows at all?
I'm getting back into not watching television, like with a remote control clicking, but I'm finding that there are some good things on television that are somewhat entertaining. The HBO is running some good series. Doctor Who. I used to watch Doctor Who when I was like a tyke, like 5, and I was just so amazed with the telephone box that traveled through time that I made one out of a refrigerator box, and here I am again, you know, 25 years later, just enthralled by Doctor Who again.
Exterminate.
I don't have a lot of free time. I work a lot, and I try to put a fair amount of effort into the show. Unfortunately, the scale has been tipped a little bit more on the work side for the last couple months. That usually corrects itself in the summer. But, I do need a way to unwind. I need a hobby.
You can always come up north.
Yeah.
Because we're in nature, so it's pretty, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Really. You guys got a hacky sack?
Hacky sacks, frisbees.
That's a good time.
Badminton.
That's the ideal number for that.
Yeah.
No, but yeah, you're right. That's a good suggestion. And where I live is beautiful too. I'm in a city, but New Hampshire is beautiful all around, and there's plenty of things to do here. And
cool.
It's outside. It's the outside time of year right now.
Indeed.
Exactly.
So, did you guys have any more questions before we wrap up with Brett?
No questions, but I'd like to make a suggestion that people Well, this is where we mentioned off air earlier, but where Adam and I got to really know you was while we were doing some rock work last summer, and we had the ability to listen to not only yours but Stefan and Rich's, like, just, you know, we were able to actually spend the time to do it. So if you have the opportunity, go get a shitty job that you don't have to really interact with people or
so
do anything.
You can get paid to listen to Brett Benoit.
And yeah, take in as many podcasts and as much info as you can.
Absolutely.
And it's kind of
so
cool.
So thanks for that.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, that you mentioned, you know, you used to listen to people from afar, and now you're actually working with them. And it's the same situation right now, right? Yeah. It's cool to sort of see the whole cycle complete, you know, and
you become part of the great conversation.
Totally.
Right? That everyone else is having this great conversation. You're like, wait, I have something to say, and I want to listen and interact.
And everyone has the power to do it.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, right? You can create your own podcast. If you've got a computer, and if you're listening to the show, you probably do, then chances are, you know, if you feel you've taken in enough and you want to not just share what you've learned, but have the discussion to bring your ideas to the table, that's what we're looking for, right? We're hoping to inspire people to not only become aware of how the world works, but to become passionate about communicating how the world works and how to make it a better place. Mm-hmm. And we need more voices. We need more articulate and intelligent and constructive and critically thinking voices and opinions to widen the field, right?
So don't be afraid to reach out.
Absolutely. And before we go, I just wanted to plug you and Stefan and Wes did a three-way episode on nonviolent communication, which I thought was really cool. Because a lot of people, when they're trying to communicate some of these ideas and stuff about education, they do it in a way that's sort of preacherly and tends to drive people away, like they're trying to convert them to a belief system. So maybe we can leave off on this idea of nonviolent communication and how effective that can be
getting across
your opinions.
Every time I've worked with the two of those guys together, I kind of feel like the kid in the back seat of the car. You know what I mean? I mean, those are just two amazing minds. But I found that was a productive conversation where Wes had really embraced these ideas, and Steph was approaching it with more skepticism. Mm-hmm. And we learned it was a difficult thing to role play, and it's certainly something that I think is well worth investigating and well worth keeping in mind as you try to become a more effective communicator, because I think that most interaction and most conflict is about both parties, or however many parties involved, trying to get some kind of need met. Mm-hmm. And it's important to understand, and I think this is something that I didn't understand for a long time, is that you have needs too, right? Like, me as the communicator, I had needs too for that conversation. It wasn't like I was schooling somebody in all the stuff that I knew, and they were, like, trying to get their need for understanding met, and I was trying to help them. Like, I have needs, I have goals for those conversations too, and I think it's important because it allows you to take a closer look at yourself and what your intentions are. Why am I having these conversations? So that's really important, but nonviolent communication will serve you best with new interactions.
Yes.
Like, unfortunately, if you have been having the same old arguments with certain friends or family members for years, even though those kind of arguments still might be instructive for other people who are watching you have them, or might be good practice for people that can actually be convinced, they have possibly been a little bit too corroded from negativity and hostility in the past, that suddenly you could introduce this new method of communicating and expect that to go off without a hitch. You know, if you say, well, I see you're feeling this, you know, as the conversation gets hostile, they're probably just going to tell you that you're an asshole, you know? So you want to try. It is a very valuable approach, and, you know, I really defer to Wes on this because he's the expert, but it seems to be most successful when encountering new people. And, you know, Rosenberg claims that this can work with anybody. People have told stories about it working while the person was, you know, the victim of an assault or a rape or the threat of that thing, which is hard to believe. But I think the most important thing is understanding that there are needs of both parties that are trying to be met by the interaction. Mm-hmm. And getting to the meta talk and understanding what those needs are, far more productive than just kind of, you know, throwing insults back and forth at each other, which is so much of what we've been led to believe that debate is through mainstream media.
So before we close off, where can people find some of your work out there and some of the collaborations that you've been doing with other people?
Sure. All the work that I've done you can find at schoolsucksproject.com. But right now that URL is just being redirected to the podcast mm-hmm. feed as we do some work on the website. Cool. So I would also recommend CompleteLiberty.com and going through all of Wes's work. I've appeared on 25 of his episodes. We did a series about education back in 2008, I want to say. We're also going to try to be increasing our YouTube presence, making some videos over the course of the next few months.
Cool.
So schoolsucksproject.com, or you can find School Sucks podcast on iTunes. And I suggest people start at the beginning, but sound quality wasn't great way back then.
You can leap in. Yeah. But it's definitely worth people's time and attention to listen to that podcast and any of the associated podcasts with the people that you work with sometimes, whether it's Wes's or Stefan's or Richard's. It's well worth people's time. Definitely. And I think it's really constructive, some of the positive changes that can come out of that. So, Brett, I just want to thank you very, very much for your time today and joining us on Remedy Radio. And
it's been awesome.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
We certainly look forward to your future work and talking with you again. So all the best. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right.
Peace.